You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, February 11th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jennifer Mittelstadt, professor of history at Rutgers, on the rise of the military welfare state. Also on the program today, the feds, they sue Ferguson when the city council decides, we didn't like that deal that we'd worked out with you guys. The non-Oregonian militia, we're not surrendering, we're turning ourselves in, they say. It's going against everything we believe in. Hopefully, we won't see any more violence with those lunatics. Meanwhile, SCOTUS tells the people to eat coal and stop trying to stop climate change. Bernie Sanders raises over $6 million the 24 hours that follow New Hampshire. We say goodbye to Chris Christie and Carly Fiorina, but really we'll spend a lot of time saying goodbye to Chris Christie. Like, we will be overly excited about saying goodbye to Chris Christie. We will harp on Chris Christie's exit on today's program. Cato rejoices. Libertarians, the largest bloc in the electorate. Bad news, libertarianism doesn't mean what they think it means. Also on the program, Syrian civil war on the cusp of becoming much larger, if that is imaginable. Talks ongoing in Munich as we speak, very important stuff. And scientists have found gravitational waves, a phenomenon that was predicted, or I guess theorized, by Albert Einstein 100 years ago. They finally found proof of the existence of these gravitational waves. We will talk about this story, which I understand none of it. 100% lack of understanding, even after reading it five times. Meanwhile, actor James Woods sues someone for calling him a coke addict on Twitter. You know that guy, the guy who's always like tweeting about how Obama's not, an American and people are scum.
I'm not saying anything, but it seems like the behavior of somebody who might be using a certain product.
I understand what you're doing there. Yeah, and I appreciate the caution that you exhibited. You can say something like, I believe, hypothetically, one could say that he's a douche, that James Woods is a douche, because that is not a specific charge. You could call him a coke addict only if you were saying, like, you're behaving like a coke addict. Like, your behavior is such, Because that's just basically a subjective analysis of his behavior.
That's really all I'm trying to say.
Or you could say, subjectively, this is a guy who's, just upset that whatever has gone wrong in his life and he's blaming it on somebody who's African-American. Now, I could say, for instance, that I rented an office from a guy who used to work with James Woods. And I rented this office now. Gosh, it's a bad situation. So it would have been 16 years ago. And he had worked with James Woods about 20 years early. And the only thing he said was, not a nice guy and got a nose job. That's what he told me. And I think he actually had a picture of him with his earlier nose. And I'll tell you something, it was not attractive.
Sounds a little Trump-like, that description.
Not
a nice guy, got a nose job.
That's what he said. It was not Donald Trump that I rented the office from. It was actually a very nice older man, who I'm probably now older than at the time, and his wife, and they were near retirement, I believe. So there's that. Let's talk about this. I'm going to just mention this gravitational wave thing only because I realize as I'm reading this thing that I don't understand how, where did I put this? Oh, here it is. I don't understand how it's so hard for me to even imagine how Einstein theorized about something like this, because I'm reading it being spoon-fed it, I should say. And I for the life of me, I can barely understand what's going on here. But apparently, scientists have detected gravitational waves. I guess gravity can move in waves, not unlike sound can move in waves. Or I guess light also. And they have determined that these waves, I guess if you think about it, just a ripple in a pond, were the product of two black holes that were 30 times the size of the sun, 1.3 billion light years from Earth, basically collided into each other. They basically had a fender bender. And they could determine the existence of these waves by using these laser beams that go 2.5 miles. So that over the course of 2.5, basically, I guess, using a level. And if you use a 36-inch level as opposed to a 4-inch level, you get a better sense of what's going on in any given plane. And they put these laser beams out there and they could see the ripples, and they had turned them into sound waves. They converted them into sound waves and they could hear it.
We have those sound waves if you want to listen to them.
Are you serious? Or are you making this up? Is this a comedy bit?
Are you about to play Marco Rubio's lip smacking?
That's the collision. Is that really it?
Yeah, that's from the New York Times. Those are the waves. they converted it into audio, basically.
Yeah, that doesn't mean anything to me. That sounds, as far as I'm concerned, that sounds like a whale. But there it is. It's a big deal. How intelligent Albert Einstein must have been to be able to theorize about something like that.
He just knew math.
Kelly just says it was no big deal. He just knew math. Well, that's all right. Maybe. It's so overrated, right?
No, I don't know math at all.
I apologize. I can't resist.
Yeah, look, Albert Einstein, whatever. He did okay. Look, I think I'm frankly better at physics than him.
He's good.
Imagine these things and then visualize them, and he just did a bunch of math problems and all this stuff.
All right, you're right. I don't mean to oversell what Albert Einstein did.
Played out, the whole Albert Einstein.
Oh, my God. It's like, God, that was 100 years ago. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, Jennifer Milstadt on the rise of the military welfare state. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor of History at Rutgers, Jennifer Mittelstadt, and on her book, The Rise of the Military Welfare State. Welcome back to the program, Jennifer.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
So this book covers a, and you know, it's interesting because I had never really contemplated the implications of the all-volunteer military in this sort of arena, I guess. I mean, you know, I think people, when we talk about the transition from a draft or a conscription military to an all-volunteer military, we talk about the implications for foreign policy and how our military is used and sort of the disconnect between the implications of going to war in the citizenry. But your book explores both the impact this move had on the military and also in terms of sort of a broader sense of citizenship on the citizenry. Pick it up on what happened when we made this transition in 19, I guess it was 73.
Yeah, well, I just want to start by saying that, you know, you're not the only one who hadn't thought about the military in this way. I certainly had never thought about the military in this way either. And the topic sort of dropped out of the sky one day for me when I was in Brooklyn walking down the street and I started eavesdropping on a cell phone conversation. And it turned out the man who I was listening to was an Army recruiter, and he was trying to convince somebody to join. And he said, among other things, the Army will get you out of credit card debt and teach you to handle your money, and you'll get child care for your kid, and you'll get health care. And I was walking along, and I was thinking, well, gosh, that sounds an awful lot like a set of social welfare programs. And social welfare programs are actually the thing that I had been studying, but in the way we normally think about it, Social Security, temporary aid to needy families, food stamps, and things like that. And it really had never occurred to me that this had happened. So that conversation sort of spurred this inquiry into the modern all-volunteer force and the role that it played in welfare. And it played a really big role, and it was the volunteer force itself which caused this switch. When the Army especially, which relied most upon the draft, had to switch from conscripting people, right, forcing them to join, to convincing them to join. And then, because it was going to need to be more of a career force, convincing them to stay, it had to think about what it was that it could offer in order to make that trade-off of joining and staying in the military look good to a wide swath of people. And for a variety of reasons that I talk about in the book, a set of social and economic support systems, what you can call a welfare state, was the answer for them. It was one answer among several.
Well, let's talk about that central. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I remember, I think, sort of really getting a first sense of consciousness of this dynamic. I think it might have been around 2009 or 2010, and I was overhearing two older guys talking about one of the guy's kid. And I heard a similar conversation, which was something to the effect of like, your kid's out of the service. Yeah, he went back in because he couldn't find a job. And that dynamic, I want to touch on that. I want to get ahead of ourselves here in terms of like that dynamic of, you know, have we set up some type of incentive system to not necessarily have the most amount of security in our civilian life economically so that we can make sure that we can provide folks for the military. But let's talk about that central argument, you know, in 1973. I don't know if it took place. I can't remember now, between Westmoreland and Milton Friedman. I mean, lay that out, because it's really dramatic. And it's also just sort of it's just a fascinating dynamic that was taking place there, this debate on how you would create this sort of really, I guess, attractive lifestyle in some way.
Yeah. Milton Friedman, who is the, you know, famed free market economist and Nobel laureate, was really the father of the all-volunteer force, and that wasn't anything that I knew prior to going into this research. Milton Friedman and a collection of free market economists had had their eye on the military as one of several American governmental institutions that they thought would work better if it was privatized or put onto a free market model. So, for example, in education, they were also inventing the idea of vouchers at this time. In public assistance, they were inventing the idea of the negative income tax. And when they looked at the military, what they thought was that institution would function better if we did not compel people to join, but rather we provided economic incentives for them to join. And so they started doing research on this and got the ear of a key Nixon aide, and then of Nixon himself. And as Nixon and all the other politicians who were running for office in 1968 looked around at the objections among the American populace to the draft, they realized the draft was highly unpopular and that ending it would be key to the political success of anyone who was going to win in 68. So actually all the candidates committed to ending the draft, and in the event Nixon wins. And so then the blueprint that goes forward is the blueprint of Milton Friedman and free market economists. And what they propose is an all-volunteer force based on income incentives, and also they propose that the military, which at that time had a limited set of military benefits, mostly which were granted on the basis of rank, so special family housing, the use of the commissaries, the PX, the post exchanges, things of that nature, they said, get rid of them. Just provide people with cash and then let them buy the support services that they think that they need. So right in the middle of this crisis moment for the Army, when they're switching over from not having the draft anymore to having to convince people, they also are facing this competition from a set of people who are far outside the military, these free market economists, who are suggesting to them to move to this completely market-based model. And William Westmoreland and
Wait, Jennifer,
other...
before we talk about that specific debate, I want to just stay on this part of it for a moment. So... Was the move to an all-volunteer army, was it a function of the political pressure that that the politicians were getting, or was it a notion of efficiency, or was it just they sort of were coincidental and basically the timing was right on both ends?
Well, I think one way to think about it is that there was a strong set of ideas floating around about the need to end the draft, mostly coming from the right. And it was connected with this principle that the government shouldn't compel you to do anything, that the best way to ensure liberty was to diminish government programs, diminish the size and scope of government where you could. And while you couldn't eliminate the military, you could switch it to a free market model. So this idea is growing, actually, among these free market economists. But really, it's the political context of the unpopularity of the Vietnam War and the unpopularity of the draft that's making this institution of the draft politically impossible anymore. So the question is, what will it look like then, the volunteer force? And it's Milton Friedman who provides the guidance for that.
And I know this is a little bit outside your portfolio, but was there any contemplation at the time? I mean, so it's like a left is to the extent that, you know, the left was against the draft because they were against the war on some level, and I think that's probably also the sort of the center of the country, and certainly the wealthy were against it because their kids were subject to, you know, I mean, a lot of them got out of the draft, obviously. And the right had ideas on efficiency. Did anybody contemplate the implications? And like I say, I know this is outside your portfolio a little bit, but did anybody contemplate the implications of what would happen with an all-volunteer force in terms of like the foreign policy issues and in terms of the sort of the relationship between the military and the civilian force, that it becomes, I mean, the civilians, that it becomes something different, that it's not an extension of your citizenry, that it becomes like you step into a different realm in some ways?
Absolutely. There really was a debate about this, and there was real concern, and some of the concern really was among Army leadership, who, although they had to really follow the mandate that Nixon was giving them and that Congress was giving them, had real concerns about what it would mean to have a military that was no longer deeply connected to the citizenry through a kind of duty and expectation. And they were nervous about what it meant for American society in general, but also what it meant for the military to have this sort of disconnected, autonomous realm where civilians weren't coming in and out and kind of bringing that outside perspective into the military. It was also a debate among military sociologists, and it's hard to imagine sometimes how academics can play a really important role in the debate, but there were really important military sociologists at the time. The two most important were a man named Charles Moskos and another named Morris Janowitz, and they were closely connected with the military. They'd written books on the military. They'd advised military commanders, and they warned in Congress of their concerns about what it meant to have essentially a separate professional force. They worried about what that would mean for the development of a kind of on-the-job attitude, just-a-job attitude mm-hmm. in the military. They worried also what it would mean for citizens in terms of whether or not they paid attention to military affairs and also to soldiers and their families. And I think they worried about what it meant more broadly for a democratic society to have military service become something that was not expected of a wide swath of the population in these emergency situations. So that debate did take place. It just was not the debate that won. The side that won, and due to the politics at the time, and as you pointed out, there's a broad coalition of people against the draft. The draft was going to go. So the question was, what would it look like on the other side?
All right. So so tell us about that that argument, I guess. I mean, literally, maybe debate between Friedman and Westmoreland.
Okay. So this debate occurs in the context of what the new volunteer force is going to look like. And Westmoreland is concerned that just offering people cash looks an awful lot like a mercenary force. And he accuses Milton Friedman in a private meeting of turning the army into a bunch of mercenaries. And Milton Friedman says in return, well, what you have now with the draft is a bunch of slaves. And he uses that word. And it sort of shows you the difference that the two men had in looking at the volunteer force, where Milton Friedman is seeking to what he thinks is free American citizens to make individual rational choices about whether or not they wish to serve. And Westmoreland is worried about what the military is going to look like when people make those decisions. And if one of the reasons they're making them is purely money, then he's wondering, will it be an effective force? Will it be a loyal force? Will it be a well-trained, reliable force? And so what happens is the Army starts to push back, not on the fact that there will be an all-volunteer force, but what will be the nature of what is offered to lure and retain people. And what Army officers from Westmoreland on argue is that cash alone is not a satisfactory answer. What we need to do is offer people the kinds of economic and social security that will not only make them materially comfortable, but will also cement their loyalty to the institution. And so this is when they start to speak about an army family. And they revive this term that had been used briefly in World War II, the army takes care of its own, as the motto for the volunteer force. So it creates a kind of social contract for someone who joins the army, then in return, they will be taken care of in a social sense, in an economic sense, and so will their family. And this kind of relationship, they theorized, was really important to the readiness, the military readiness, the loyalty, the cohesion, the morale in the Army going forward, and it was going to be central to the institution. In the event, they also asked soldiers, of course, what is it that you want? What would convince you to join? And they asked the ones who were in, what will convince you to stay? And the number one thing that they said was having benefits. So it came from a place of their own theorizing about what would be best for the military based on their experience, but it also came from the soldiers' own mouths that what they wanted were these were these benefits to help them and their family.
What's really fascinating to me, and I had never really sort of contemplated, was that notion of when we gave benefits, like when we gave the GI, when we created the GI Bill, right? It is benefits for military personnel to basically help them reintegrate into society, right? So that their military service is seen as part of a whole of being a citizen of this country. And this, you know, something like this is going to pay for your college when you get out of the military is going to sort of help that reintegration, make it not part of a whole rather than this sort of like time out from their lives in some way. And when it becomes an all-volunteer army, it's really about how do we create like almost like a sub-state in some way, right? Like you're all going to Scandinavia now for the rest of your lives. It's just going to be, we're going to call it the U.S. Military.
Well, it's the GI Bill is actually a really instructive example because you're right. When it's first created, it's a reward for citizens for having done their duty and sacrificed during a time of war. The GI Bill exists for World War II. It exists for the Korean War. It exists for the Vietnam War. But after the end of the Vietnam War, Congress votes to get rid of it because there's not a conflict. And they said, anyway, we're switching to a volunteer force. So we don't need to create this situation where we're rewarding citizens for having, you know, put in this time during wartime and we're helping ease a transition back to peacetime. It's not necessary. So they got rid of it. And this posed a real crisis, it turned out, for the Army in particular, which, as I said, had relied so much on the draft. It started to see the GI Bill as essential, not as a reward for people for having served, but to get them to join in the first place. So it became essential for the functioning, in their mind, of the volunteer force to be able to offer this kind of reward. And so, yeah, it symbolizes the other programs, too, the new housing programs that are created, the accompanied tours where soldiers who are posted to Germany can bring their families along, the creation later in the 1980s of child care and a wide variety of family support programs. These all are not so much rewards for having served. They're the prerequisite for having people come in and then retaining them. So they do serve a very different function from the original GI Bill.
And in fact, they don't want, I mean, right, if I'm a military that's looking to retain the GI Bill, or at least the part that will pay for your education, your higher education outside of the military, right, it's an enticement, but you don't really, once you get them in, right, you don't want them to go out and use that necessarily.
Yeah, that's been an ongoing debate, and in recent years, you've heard that fairly often in Congress, and John McCain, for one, has been one of the most vocal critics, in some sense, of the GI Bill, because he points out that it's an incentive to leave the service. But this also raises another function of the GI Bill that we haven't talked about yet, and one that's particularly important for the Army. And here's where the story, I think, about the welfare programs associated with the military become complicated. On the one hand, military leadership wants and needs these programs. On the other hand, the military leadership is uncomfortable in some ways with these programs. And the GI Bill is instructive as to why. When the switch occurs in the 1970s to the volunteer force, the composition of the volunteer force of the military changes markedly. So whereas the draft had sort of ensured a fair representation of Americans from a variety of class and race backgrounds and had been more representative of those percentages of those people in the population, the switch to the volunteer force alters that. And the volunteer force in the 1970s rapidly becomes a force that has less income than the average American. It is less educated than the average American, and it is more African-American than the regular population. And so the composition of the force is altering. Probably most markedly, women are joining for the first time, because the volunteer force is really a no-go if they're not going to bring women in. It just can't function. It won't have enough manpower. So all of a sudden, soldiers look different. And at that same time, the military welfare state is growing, and there's some concern about whether or not there's some connection between this demographic coming into the Army and the programs that are growing to serve them. And it makes some people uncomfortable, and they worry about what a lower income, less educated military is going to mean in the long run. And so here's where the GI Bill comes in. What Army leadership starts to think is, not only can we use it to recruit and retain people, but we can use it as a marker of sort of upward aspiring, upward mobility, that yes, we might be drawing in people who are more from the margins of American society, but we can show that these are people who want to move up in the world, who want to make their way in the world, because they're coming here in part to get the GI Bill. And so it serves, in a way, a kind of symbolic function at a time of crisis demographically for the Army in presenting them as an institution that kind of embodies the upward aspiring notions of American citizenship at that time, even if the demographics are looking different.
Interesting. So it's almost like the GI Bill becomes sort of one of those personality tests that you take in some way, right? It's just sort of supposed to attract people who are aspirational in some way, I guess.
That's right. Although, you know, the truth is, the evidence suggests that it does function more symbolically than anything else, because the data don't show that the GI Bill makes an enormous difference in recruitment. It makes a very small difference in the recruitment of what the military would call high-quality personnel. So personnel with who score high on the tests and who have perhaps some college. It doesn't actually show that it makes an enormous difference in recruiting them. So then you ask yourself, why is it there? And I think it is there in part because it serves that symbolic function. And also the symbolic function of sort of symbolizing the extra sort of super citizenship of military personnel who volunteer.
Tell us about this. I also found this fascinating, that there was an attempt by, was it AFSCME, to unionize soldiers at that time, right? Because they're going in for a career, almost like a civil service, except for it's not. It's military service, but it's almost... becoming a soldier or military personnel is at least akin in terms of a career arc to join the post office, I guess.
That's right. So this was really an unexpected finding for me, and it's something that actually helped me really figure out what these programs meant to the military and what they meant to soldiers. So this is right after the military has switched to a volunteer force in 1973. 2 years later, the American Federation of Government Employees, which is the largest federal employee union, just looks around at a time when benefits are being cut for civil service workers and said, where could we sort of get some more political leverage? And the all-volunteer force looks to them new and looks like it might be a good place to get some political support. So they reach out to military service personnel, first, in asking them to please write letters on their behalf to keep civil servants' pay from being frozen. Military members do this because their pay is pegged to civilian workers. So they go ahead and do this. And then the AFSCME says, well, maybe we'll just try to unionize them. And they make this vote. They reach out to military personnel on that and find, surprisingly to many people, that over a third of military personnel are actually interested in unionizing. And in the event, it never happens. The military leadership pushes back hard. Congress pushes back hard. The media finds it sort of a ridiculous notion. But in the debate that ensues, one of the things that becomes clear is how uncomfortable the military is just with the plain idea that the volunteer force is somehow a job. And it's uncomfortable with the idea that the benefits that they are increasingly providing now to these volunteer soldiers are somehow employee benefits or fringe benefits or something like that. What they want to do is go back to this idea that I was talking about earlier, that these benefits are actually part of an Army family providing for itself, taking care of its own. It's outside the boundaries of the market. It's outside the boundaries of an employee relationship. And it's more a paternal relationship. And these benefits, therefore, are not subject to
negotiation,
some kind of collective right. bargaining, yeah, or negotiation. Rather, they're a really important separate category of special services that are given to military personnel because their service is not actually comparable with civilian employment. And precisely because of that lack of comparability, the military will actually be able to argue successfully, both in the 1970s and then beyond, that these need to be increased when even civilian social welfare is being decreased, when private employers are decreasing their provision of employee benefits. The military will be able to carve out this special space by insisting that it is not, in fact, a job, and these are not employee benefits. There's something special.
Interesting. I mean, and so we have three basic models, I guess, of military service, right? One is as an extension of your citizenry and something you do in a time of crisis, and we help you reintegrate back into society and reward you for doing that. The other is this model of, you know, we just pay you a lot of money and right. make it attractive. And I'm sort of this career track. And the third is you are joining a fraternity, I guess, or a family, as you say. I mean, I want to jump up to the time where the enhancement of the military welfare state is directly tied to the decreasing of the civilian welfare state. But also, can you juxtapose, I mean, when we have this dynamic where it's almost like, you know, I have friends who are professors and they live on campus and they've got, there's the gym there and there's the swimming pool that they go to on campus, and their lives are basically, you know, there's certain, they've get a full complement. I mean, it sort of has that quality to it on some level, and it's very attractive. Like you're sort of almost like taking yourself out of society in some ways, and some of the concerns that you have on a daily basis are just not there. How do societies, I want to talk about that sort of that zero-sum game that happens under Reagan, but how does this work in societies that have a very robust social welfare state? Like, I mean, if we were to go to Scandinavia, like what is the trade-off there? Or is that why they have to have, in some of these countries, you know, sort of mandatory service?
So this is just a great question, and it circles right around the thing, I think one of the central questions that people who are interested in studying politics and social welfare are asking themselves, and that is sort of why are there, if we look at different countries, various arrangements of how societies take care of the basic well-being of their populations? We have in Europe, as you alluded to, a sort of very different, universal, comprehensive model of social welfare that's available to all citizens. And for many years, people looked at the United States and said, sort of, there really isn't a welfare state here. Yeah, there's the New Deal. It only reached certain people. The U.S. doesn't care about social welfare. In fact, if you look carefully around different places in American society, what you'll see is that the government over the years has encouraged different forms of social welfare. Some of them are public, and very obvious and explicitly governmental, like Social Security, for example. But others are subsidies to corporations to have the corporations themselves provide things like health care or pensions, for example. Some are hidden, and you can't see them very well, like the income tax system, which actually rewards certain kinds of behaviors and provides money for social welfare, and whether they're dependent children supports or child care or education supports or
mortgage,
you know,
interest,
discounts for
tax
housing,
deduction.
Mortgages,
right.
Exactly. It's hidden in all these ways. And the military in the United States is actually one of these institutions that performs, not as its main purpose, but nevertheless performs an important social welfare function for people. So this question, I think, really is at the center of why I got interested in this. But still, there remains this other question that you asked, which is, so what did other countries do? So other countries in Europe were switching also in this period to a volunteer force. And they had to think, too, about, well, how is it that we lure and retain people? In the event, social welfare did not emerge for them as something important. Why? Because they already had universal social welfare programs. And so they were going to have to operate their systems with different sets of incentives. The U.S., in the U.S. case, military personnel, army leadership, were quite aware that Europeans had social welfare states, and they saw it as a comparative advantage for them to offer these programs because they knew civilians couldn't get them
right.
in everyday life. So, I mean, that was an explicit discussion. There were studies done about this, about how social welfare could serve as a comparative advantage for the U.S. military in a country that didn't provide as much as other countries did.
So it's not, we don't really have a social welfare state. We have a series of social welfare substates in many respects. And the military was fully conscious of the fact that people prefer to live in a socialist state. And so much so that we could actually sort of say, like, this is what we get provide for you for potentially having to deploy to a desert and to kill people. I mean, that's basically right. I mean, that's what they realize. Like, this is the most enticing thing we can offer that will retain presence. Because I guess if we offer the money, at one point people will just say, I'm leaving now because I'm rich.
Well, yeah. I mean, so they realize that they have this comparative advantage. But then again, it provides this other function for them in which it cements the loyalty
right.
of military personnel to the institution, which is understandably seen as vital for a mission of an institution like the military, where people have to put their lives on the line and make enormous sacrifices.
And it replaces on some level. I mean, I can imagine some military personnel finding this a little bit offensive, but it replaces on some level the idea of patriotism, right? Or of citizenry, doesn't it? I mean, because it is a loyalty to the institution that they're trying to develop, as opposed to loyalty to the society of which this is a means in which to help the society at that time?
You know, I think that's a really good question, and I'm not sure I have the answer to it, but I think you have your finger on sort of the central issue at stake here. When the states, so let's like back out, when governments decide how they're going to provide support for citizens, when they decide what groups get what, they are sort of setting up questions about what is valued, who is valued, what is not valued, and who is not valued. And I think that these questions do swirl around this question of the military's welfare state. So people are recruited, and they are retained, and they are given these benefits as part of that recruitment and retention process and as part of the functioning of it. But what does that mean to them? What does that mean to the people who create the programs? What does that mean to the people who experience it? What does that mean to their connection to the institution, but then to the larger nation? I don't think there's one answer to that, and I don't think it's entirely clear. But I think that if we look at the history of how these programs develop, we see one area of caution, and that is this. As the military developed these programs, military leadership and soldiers and their families made efforts to distinguish and demarcate the programs that they got as fundamentally different from any programs that civilian got. So I mentioned that with reference to the military not being a job. But they also went to great lengths to say, actually the opposite of the title of my book, to great lengths to say that the military is not a welfare state. We have these programs, but it's not welfare. So they built it and hid it at the same time. They sort of relied on it and shielded it from that kind of association. And I think probably with good reason, because the welfare state was not a popular term in the late 1970s, 1980s, or 1990s, and it was politically under fire. And so they were really able to cleave themselves off from civilians and thereby preserve these programs and this status.
It's a fascinating book, and there's a lot more in there too about the sort of the rise of a
I mean, I guess one you could call it a feminism, or at the very least, activism on the part of, because you have now a military that is focused on retaining people through their lives, that means that they go through different life cycles than they would have with a conscription army. So you have families and children and then, of course, other services as it gets older, so that it changes the entire dynamic. But Jennifer Millistat, the book is The Rise of the Military Welfare State. We will put a link at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. It's fascinating stuff.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. A reminder, this program relies on its members to exist. And as a thank you, what we do is we invite you into our own little welfare state where we provide for you an extra 50 minutes, hour, 90 minutes, well, 40 minutes? I don't know, not really. Usually more of programming on a daily basis. So you get a choice. You can either choose, you can either listen to the entire show. Some days you can listen to the first half or the second half. I think what we're going to maybe trying to do soon with the membership show, and I keep teasing the idea that we're going to do surveys, and during the break when we're going to be having pre-recorded shows, I will be working on surveys. But I think what we may try and do is actually offer two shows. It won't be any more content, but it'll be organized slightly different. Just got a IM about Triumph, the insult comic. We may have him tomorrow on the program. I'm working on it. I'm working on it. We also just got an IM that I just saw. They flash up for a moment that said, nice audio work, new dork. Not.
What's wrong with the audio work today?
No, but I think if someone at this point, I like to think that our audience is sophisticated enough that if they use the not, then they're using it doubly ironically. They're mocking themselves when they use that. That's the way I like to think. I mean, I know there are some people, but mostly they're conservatives who use not still in the without it being ironic. That's the problem with that character. They use that ironically, and then people adopted it earnestly, and then it's...
It's like Nick Offerman's Ron Swanson character in Community.
Right. He becomes a hero.
Parks and Rec, yeah.
Folks, also remind you, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY for 10% off. And also, if you buy your crap from Amazon... Buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. If you are looking for another online service in which to purchase your stuff that has great prices and apparently treats their workers quite well, they're not union, but there's a quote from a New York Times piece where a union guy said, like, I've never gone and talked to workers who are better off than this. Jet.com. We also have a link for Jet.com at majorityreportkickback.com. All right, folks. See you in the fun half. We'll be right back. Such an apple pie.